However you slice it, America is intentionally under attack by many incarnations of foreign infiltration.
It's not Genocide Joe that has to go. It's the entire system that has to go.
Whether it's the blunt, dull force of the open jihad growing within the interior of the United States.
Quote, almost immediately after the October 7th attack, people were celebrating in the streets in Dearborn.
Why can't you just say whether or not you condemn people chanting death to America? Why are you afraid to talk to Fox
News? Listen, using racist tropes towards my community is what Fox News is about, and I don't talk to Fox News.
Is death to America racist?
Or the hordes of bloodthirsty Haitians storming the beaches of Florida.
Florida's governor deploying more patrols to the state's southern coast and plans to install new leadership in Haiti appears to be crumbling.
And even the U.S. Marines are being sent into Haiti to help secure the U.S. embassy there. But in the worst areas where that chaos is happening, we know that there are a number of U.S. citizens that are literally stranded.
Or the now rampant looting of the United States infrastructure that has no end in sight.
Six additional buses arrived at the Port Authority bus terminal overnight.
This comes after 14 buses arrived from Texas.
Tonight, another major U.S. city, San Diego, buckling as it grapples with a growing number of migrants. Border Patrol dropping off hundreds of people at local bus stops from as far away as China.
No country comes remotely close to executing the art of war as China does with its methodical, creeping disintegration warfare being waged on the United States of America. Author Peter Schweitzer writes that disintegration warfare, in the Chinese leader's words, is going after the United States' soft underbelly in terms of politics, economics, and the spirit and psychology of its people. Disintegration warfare is based on the ancient Chinese strategist and general Sun Tzu's teachings on how to win a war without fighting. The strategy is aimed at undermining a rival country's, quote, national will, values, and cohesion, end quote. A Chinese immigrant who is now a U.S. congressional candidate has warned Americans not to underestimate China's use of soft power to infiltrate the United States and achieve global dominance.
I know what no freedom of speech is what I'm all about. I know what big government is all about.
China is investigating and logging every weakness in American national security it can find.
China is buying up some American farmland. The question is China doing that to spy on the U.S. military?
What we're seeing now is a continuing trend and an uptick in these intrusions.
According to the Wall Street Journal, the FBI, Department of Defense, and others have been conducting a year-long investigation into so-called gate crashers. It's happening all over the U.S., according to the report. In Florida, Chinese scuba divers were caught swimming in dirty water near a government rocket launch site. In New Mexico, the gate crashers attempted to breach a missile launch location. Officials even caught Chinese nationals leaving a tour of the White House, attempting to take photos of Secret Service and communications equipment.
Meanwhile, the Chinese are pouring fuel on the fire of gang violence that is tearing cities apart. As Breitbart reports, cities such as St. Louis continue to devolve into war zones. This, in large part, to the fact that the communist Chinese government has been flooding the United States with illicit gun parts.
A penny-sized device can turn a semi-automatic weapon into one that can fire up to 1,100 bullets a minute with one pull of the trigger. ATF agent Tony Pierce demonstrated the machine gun conversion device, commonly known as a Glock switch, at a gun range in Slidell.
With the regular Glock setup in semi-automatic, it's much easier to control the shots because you have time to allow the weapon to cycle, and you're able to control your recoil.
The weapon is harder to handle when it's fully automatic using the illegal switch.
A lot of times on the street, guys are shooting with one hand, and to try to control this with just one hand would be nearly impossible. And you're going to have innocent bystanders in the background, in the foreground, who could also get hit by this.
Records reveal that between 2019 and 2021, there was a rise of 4,200% in incidents involving machine gun fire in 130 American cities. The Chinese flooding of third world America with Glock switches, ensuring that the mass murder of innocent civilians will eventually lead to sweeping gun control legislation. Solution? Close the border.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the American Journal. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Very big show we have for you today. I'm very excited about our guest. We'll be joined in about an hour by Ian Carroll from Cancel This Clothing Company, who's been making major waves on TikTok, and now he's expanding elsewhere, but really setting a new standard in conspiracy content. Very excited to talk to him about, well, the document that I call the Eagle 2 document. He calls it the Five-Star Trust, but it is the leaked FBI document that lays out with names, dates, times, everything, the way that the CIA started selling drugs, and everything went downhill from there. So I'm going to be doing a little history lesson, I think, and talking about what we can glean about today's society from the past actions of our intelligence agencies. The video that you just saw is from John Bowne, band.video and Infowars.com. Gatecrashers, China's disintegration warfare. If you want to find and share that video, we'd greatly appreciate it. And of course, there's always a download button right there on the page. You can download the full HD version. And if you click the share button, it gives you a disguised link so you can still post it on even controlled social media. Disintegration warfare sounds a lot cooler than it is. Sounds like some sort of sci-fi laser weapon. But no, it's Chinese people selling guns to Mexican people. That's what disintegration warfare is. Not as exciting as you might think. We have a lot of stories to get into today, a lot of updates to long-running shows. We'll do an update on what's going on in Lahaina, Maui, 8 months after the mysterious fires burned everything there. We have a lot of videos of just what's going on in the world today. Stay tuned for that, but let's begin today, as we do every day, with our Daily Dispatch. All right, here it is, folks. Your Daily Dispatch for Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2024. A breaking update from Conservative Roof. Federal agents boarded the 985-foot dolly early Monday with search warrants. That is, of course, the ship that crashed into the Key Bridge in Baltimore, collapsing it. Two high-ranking law enforcement officials familiar with the matter have revealed that the FBI is now conducting a criminal investigation into the cargo ship responsible for colliding with the Francis Scott Key Bridge, leading to its collapse in Baltimore last month. On Monday morning, federal agents executed search warrants aboard the 985-foot dolly. Baltimore FBI confirmed Monday agents were on board conducting court-authorized law enforcement activity. Sources indicate that the investigation will delve into the circumstances preceding the ship's departure from the port. So it appears as though there may be more than meets the eye. Maybe us crazy conspiracy theorists saying there was something a bit suspicious about a ship driving headlong into the pylons of a bridge, collapsing the whole thing in an instant. Yeah, maybe we weren't so crazy after all. I guess we'll wait and see. I guess we'll have to just wait and see. Now that it's in the FBI's hands, I know we'll get to the bottom of it. Nothing fills me with confidence like knowing the American Federal Bureau of Investigation is on the case. Now I know that wrongdoers won't get away with their evil activities. We can rest assured knowing that the patriots at the FBI will get to the bottom of this, and then they'll just let us know. They'll let us know what they figured out. Yeah, that's we're never going to learn anything, by the way. That's what that means. The FBI has shown up, they'll file a report, and then that report will go missing, and that'll be the end of the story. Let's continue. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators shut down airport highways and bridges yesterday. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators blocked roadways in Illinois, California, New York, and the Pacific Northwest on Monday, temporarily shutting down travel into some of the nation's most heavily used airports onto the Golden Gate and Brooklyn bridges and a busy West Coast highway. In Chicago, protesters linked arms and blocked lanes of Interstate 190 leading to O'Hare International Airport around 7 a.m. in a demonstration that they said was part of a global economic blockade to free Palestine, according to Rivka Falena, one of the organizers. And guess what? It turns out it worked, and Palestine's free now. Isn't that amazing? America doesn't support Israel anymore, and Palestine is free, and the war is over. You did it, you guys. Congratulations. It worked. I can't believe it. I mean, you'd think this type of thing would do nothing other than enrage the average person. You would think that blocking bridges and airports would achieve absolutely nothing geopolitically, but actually harden the stance of the people that are against you and push more people that are neutral into the screw these stupid protesters camp. But no, it turned out it worked perfectly, and now there's peace in the world. Thanks, you guys. You did it. Congratulations. Of course, they also tried to block roads and bridges in places like Florida, and the police simply dragged them away. It turns out that it's a choice whether your entire nation is held hostage by foreign activists, or you can just not allow them to do that. It's entirely up to you. Meanwhile, Israel vows to respond to unprecedented Iranian missile and drone attack, raising concerns of regional war. Axios reports that the Biden administration and several other Western countries allied with Israel are urging Benjamin Netanyahu's government to exercise caution and avoid rushing into retaliation against Iran that could lead to a regional war. And again, you might be surprised to hear that it completely worked, and Israel was like, yeah, you're right, you know, we should be calm here. We shouldn't just fly off the handle and start murdering everybody. You're right. We've done some deep thinking, and now we've decided that revenge is not at the top of priority list, and we're not going to start World War III. Kidding. I'm kidding, of course. Was it obvious? Was my sarcasm blatant enough? No, they're going to do whatever they want whenever they want, because the people that could stand up against them are instead blackmailed into submission. That would be the American government. We could at any point stop the Israeli government from lashing out relentlessly against innocent people vaguely related to their enemies. But yeah, we haven't done it yet. No sign of any change anytime soon. And of course, for the last 6 months, it's been a habit of ours we've developed where we beg Israel not to do something suicidally and or homicidally stupid, and then they do it anyway, and then we give them billions of dollars and protect them from any backlash. So that'll keep going as long as we're ruled by the people we're ruled by, and they're ruled by the people they're ruled by. So no change there. Then we have this. FISA moves to Senate without provision requiring warrants to conduct searches of Americans. On Monday, a congressional vote to move 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act bill to the Senate succeeded in the House with a vote of 259 to 128. The bill now goes to the Senate without any provision requiring warrants on the surveillance of Americans who are in communication with foreign actors. Again, we've talked pretty extensively about this. It's not a matter of this bill, this FISA bill, changing the way that America operates. It's just a matter of making legal what they've been doing forever, and that actions that are blatantly unconstitutional. So that's what's happening in America. Finally, we have this. More than a dozen states quarantine cows to halt spread of bird flu as experts grow increasingly worried about outbreak in people. Health officials in 18 states have placed restrictions on cattle movement. States like New York have warned residents to keep their distance from wildlife. Bird flu outbreak in New York City animals prompts new health alert. Health officials in 18 states placed restrictions on imports of cattle from states where the bird flu, also known as H5N1, has been confirmed in dairy cows, which is good, you know. Don't import the cows. The problem is that birds fly and tend not to adhere to trade restrictions between states. So this will continue to spread. And I imagine maybe a week from now, there will be demands that entire cattle herds are culled to prevent the spread of bird flu, which again is just extremely coincidental and convenient for the people that are actively trying to destroy our entire food system. Isn't it amazing when nature simply gifts them a disease that fulfills so many of their goals? Isn't that such a wild and unexpected coincidence? That's your Daily Dispatch. Everything sucks, but we're still here, and we could do lots of things about this if we simply choose to. I do want to let you know that one of the best-selling and most popular products on the InfoWars store is back in stock and on sale. A reintroductory price of 40% off. It's Vitamin Mineral Fusion, the platinum standard of advanced multivitamin formulas. It's back in stock. After being out for months, there's no better time to make sure that you're boosting your natural systems and getting your essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients than with Vitamin Mineral Fusion, back in stock and 40% off. Vitamin C, D, E, and B12, calcium, magnesium, zinc, selenium, L-glutamine, CoQ10, and so many more vital nutrients in one scoop of Vitamin Mineral Fusion. This is like the introductory product. It's like if you aren't sure about supplements, if you've never tried them, you think you're doing all right without them, you know, maybe you don't want to go full bore with something like Real Red Pill Plus that's just hard-hitting and savage. But you understand vitamins and minerals, right? You understand vitamin C and D and E. You understand that your food is depleted of natural vitamins and minerals, so you have to be supplementing in this. It's an extremely easy and, frankly, delicious way to do it. Vitamin Mineral Fusion, back in stock and on sale at 40% off. Even just talking about it, it's making me kind of thirsty. I'm kind of craving it now. I'll have to get a scoop myself during the break. It really is a great product and one of the most popular ones. And, of course, this is not one that only a few – literally everybody should be taking this product. Literally everyone in America should be taking Vitamin Mineral Fusion for their health. Now, we have a lot of videos to get to here today. And there's one that I was just thinking of because of a story that we just read. Oh, this one, clip number 7. Let's go to clip number 7 here, because this, we've been covering ways that they're doing this in a variety of different strategies they're taking. One of them is to list natural resources on a form of a stock market, kind of adding nature itself to the stock market and merchandising it, basically merchandising nature itself so it can be traded and given a dollar value and then leveraged against other dollar value things. Basically, they want the entire natural world merchandised, commodified. Thank you, Matt, the mind reader there. Give me the word I wanted. Commodified. Yeah. So they're doing that, and that's one way that they're doing it. The other way that they're doing it is they're claiming that farming and hunting and fishing, even growing gardens, is a form of a new word they've come up with, ecocide. Ecocide is their new phrase, their new term that they've come up with to criminalize existence. So let's go now to this World Economic Forum panelist, Jojo Mehta, co-founder of Stop Ecocide, an activist who, again, wants to make illegal the actions necessary for basic human survival. Let's watch.
Since we have to accelerate action and ambition from all sides, not only business, governments as well. And I think also, like, there's a lot of individual change that we have to promote to really get where we need to get. So you work on a very new concept called ecocide. So many people don't understand what this legal definition is and what does it bring. So can you please explain a little bit to us, but also tell us, in your opinion, what has to change in current business and investment models to make sure this long-term thinking and ecological considerations are included in decisions and practices?
Absolutely. So, I mean, ecocide as a word is becoming more, it's becoming better known around the world, and the concept is generally mass damage and destruction of nature. But legally speaking, what our organization and other collaborators aim to do is to have this recognized legally as a serious crime. Because one of the issues that sort of pervades all of this discussion is that we have a kind of cultural, very ingrained habit of not taking damage to nature as seriously as we take damage to people and property. And that, I mean, you know, if you're campaigning for human rights, at least you know mass murder, torture, all of these things are serious crimes. But there's no equivalent in the environmental space. And unlike an international crime like genocide that involves a specific intent, with ecocide, what we see is actually what people are trying to do, what businesses are trying to do, is make money, is farm, is fish, is do all of these things that are producing energy and so on as well. But what's missing is the awareness and the conscience around the side effects, around the collateral damage that happens with that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all talking a little bit as though, you know, the changes that are happening and the shocks that are happening are inevitable. But actually, there are quite simple, for example, you know, with ecocide, it's a really straightforward kind of intervention at the legal level that could actually start to steer everything in a healthier direction.
It's from Wide Awake Media. So in case you missed it there, she did mention farming and fishing as being ecocidal activities, equivalent to, in her estimation, genocide. After all, she's upset that we don't treat destruction of nature as seriously as we treat destruction of human beings. Now, as much as I am a lover of nature, as much as I hate seeing nature destroyed, I would cut down 1,000 trees before I'd kill a single human being. These things are not equivalent. That should be obvious. She also is talking, of course, exclusively to Western countries, which is ironic considering that Western countries are and have always been extremely concerned about the environment, concerned about being stewards of the earth, stewards of nature, not doing things in a way that irrevocably destroys the natural world. We are not the ones that need that lecture. If you want to actually stop ecocide, if that's the term you're coining, we should probably be going to like war with China. We should probably be doing everything we possibly can to stop Africa. just tell them to stop. They can just stop now. Considering that, you know, oceans are just filled with plastics, and 99% of it comes from the Yangtze River and a river in India. You know, we're not the ones that they should be lecturing to, and yet we're the only ones they are lecturing to. Why? Because it's not actually about saving the environment. It's about using, in sort of an ironic or just inverted sort of way, you're going to browbeat the people that do have environmental concerns and restrictions about protecting the environment. You're going to browbeat them with the guilt they feel about the environment that they do, you know, continue to damage, to destroy them completely. And what we'll be left with is a worldwide India, videos of which you're seeing now. And good Lord, it's hell. It is straight up hell itself. And if you, again, if this was really the concern, and these people, they seem to be able to comprehend side effects. They seem to be able to comprehend, you know, multi-level consequences to things. If these people were serious about protecting the environment, there would first of all be a massive push to end global free trade, as we simply save money by using slave labor in China, because we don't have to worry about the overhead of things like recycling or responsible destruction of waste products that are created in the manufacturing of goods. You know, if you do something in America, you have to, especially if you're using toxic elements, you're going to have to pay to have those environmental effects mitigated. You're going to have to pay for destroying these things. And in fact, you're probably going to have to pay a company to ship them to a place like Jakarta or India, where they can just live in it, I guess. They can just throw it in the ocean for us. They can just put it in their rivers instead of ours, out of sight, out of mind. So you would stop things like international free trade that allow these corporations to avoid environmental concerns by outsourcing their operations to China or India, who have no such concerns. And you'd probably want to advocate some form of neocolonialism, where the European countries that are concerned about the world use force and aggression to put a stop to the wholesale destruction of the earth that is being carried out by people that aren't listening to the World Economic Forum, that don't care what they have to say, and that can't be browbeaten into just basic ecological concerns. That's not what they're doing, obviously, because that's not what the actual goal of any of this is. Farming and fishing being examples of ecocide. So a little bit like saying the neonatal emergency room is a form of genocide. It's the opposite of reality. I mean, it really is sort of beyond ridiculous. But they just say this. They just do this. I mean, talk to any hunter, talk to any fisherman, talk to any farmer, and then talk to anybody that hangs out at World Economic Forum. Tell anybody that's in a think tank in San Francisco or New York, who do you think is more in tune with nature? Who do you think cares more about nature? Who do you think is doing more and contributing more to the preservation of nature? Do you think it's somebody who subsists entirely on food shipped in from 10,000 miles away into their massive poisonous city? Or do you think it's the farmer actually on the land who's developed a sustainable form of agriculture or livestock husbandry that their family's been practicing for generation upon generation? Who do you trust more with the earth itself? Again, if you are concerned about ecocide, not only would shipping things across the Pacific Ocean be, you know, should be top of your list, you should also, you know, probably want to, I mean, I guess they can just stop eating. I guess anybody who's concerned about ecocide can just stop eating. And the real concerning thing about this, my wife has a coworker who, her coworker and her husband are normal people, total, just like actually pretty conservative, but their daughter got sent to a public school, and at first grade was browbeaten and guilted into thinking that by eating meat she was killing the earth, and has now gone vegetarian. And that's a different coworker, I should remind you, than the one that kindergartner came home saying that she was a boy. So this poison is being poured into the minds of children, and they're killing themselves. All right, welcome back, folks. We got a lot of stories to cover today. I don't want to go to a video here. It's a little bit longer, but it's worth it. It is certainly worth it because it is Peter McCullough, friend of the show, absolutely dominating a debate or a unfriendly interviewer about the effects of the COVID vaccine. And I want to go to this now because it's, it really is a masterclass. And this guy, this Shapiro guy, is such a typical, just narrative following, unquestioning guinea pig that it's nice to see him utterly humbled, not by, you know, just somebody on the right wing, a talking head spokesperson, but Dr. Peter McCullough, an eminently highly regarded professional doctor, epidemiologist, expert in all of these things. It's just nice to see the utterly uninformed mainstream media brain go up against the expert in his field who calmly eviscerates every argument this scumbag makes. Let's go now to clip number three. Here's Dr. Peter McCullough, very calmly, very methodically, destroying the pro-vax arguments.
I want to talk about vaccines with you. Would you agree with me that the vaccines for COVID have done far more good for people in this country than not good? There are so many people still that say COVID, the vaccines have killed millions of people, that all these professional athletes are dying of myocarditis when it's just not true. So would you agree with me that the vaccines have done far more good for people than bad?
Well, what evidence do you have for that?
What evidence do you have that all these people are dying of the vaccines?
Well, let's just take let's take safety first, because we always discuss safety before efficacy. Would you agree with that?
Sure.
Yeah, right. So it doesn't matter how good a product is, it has to be safe. Would you agree with that?
I don't think there's any vaccination that's 100% foolproof safe. You know that.
Okay, but it would have to have acceptable safety. Would you agree with that?
It depends what your definition of acceptable safety is. We were in a global pandemic where at one point we were losing 5,000 Americans per day. So obviously these were extenuating circumstances, mm-hmm. but go ahead. Mm-hmm.
But what would be your definition of acceptable safety?
While I'm not a doctor and you are, I would say in my personal opinion, looking back on half the world being vaccinated, in fact, more than half the world, as you know, at this point.
All right. Let me just pause it real quick. I hate everything about this Brian Shapiro guy. It's every single thing he says.
What is it about those Shapiros?
Oh, it's those Shapiros. There's something about them. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I don't know what it is. So like, even just from the very first exchange, right? He makes a very forthright statement, a claim. He makes a claim, right? He says the safety of the vaccine, like the vaccine is totally safe. What he exactly said was it did way more good than harm. Peter McCullough is like, what's your proof of that? It's like, oh, well, what's your proof that it's killing all of these people? It's like, well, you made the claim. Do you have any evidence to back that up? The fact that you start, you know, casting the burden of proof on Peter McCullough means no, you don't have any ability to make that claim. And just everything, it's, you know, it's sort of a emblematic of so many discussions that are had these days where it's the expert just saying very normal, calm things and the leftist activists just using a variety of rhetorical trickery to try to obfuscate and distract and confuse when he's the one that set this whole thing up and is leading the conversation. That's just, I hate this guy. I hate everything about him. But so I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt. But let's go back to Brian Shapiro questioning Dr. Peter McCullough and being incapable of seemingly even comprehending a direct question or statement without warping it beyond recognition. Sorry, let's go back.
That these vaccinations people are dropping dead left and right. And as you know, specifically on right-wing media and right-wing talk shows, they claim that all these professional athletes are dying of myocarditis because of the vaccines when they don't even know if these people were vaccinated. They don't know their medical history.
What are they dying of, Brian?
And it's frustrating for me, doctor, because I believe the vaccine saved my life. I believe it saved my parents' life.
Okay, hold on. Let's pause it there. Pause it there. He just said, I believe the vaccine saved my life. What does that mean? What does that mean? I have a feeling Brian Shapiro got vaccinated, got COVID, and almost died of COVID. That's my supposition. Because why else would he say that the vaccine almost saved his life? In his mind, he got the vaccine, he got COVID, he almost died from COVID. He thought, man, if I hadn't gotten that vaccine, I definitely would have died. What else? What other option is there? Who says the vaccine saved my life? That is impossible to know. Did he never get COVID? So he got the vaccine. He never got COVID. Now he says the vaccine saved his life. No, he got the vaccine. He got COVID. He got extremely sick with COVID. In his mind, he wasn't killed. It didn't go even further because he had the vaccine, which made his case of COVID lesser than it would have been. I just wanted, that's my interpretation of that.
It gave him peace of mind.
It gave him peace of mind. Yeah, if he'd been more anxious, it would have killed him, I'm sure. But he said the vaccine saved my life. So this is the thing. He's out there, again, just building straw men. You know, when we point out, hey, there's a rash, there's a bizarre trend of healthy high school athletes, healthy college athletes, healthy young athletes at the peak of their physical condition dropping over dead with no preconditions. That seems kind of weird, and it seems to coincide perfectly with the rollout of the vaccine and the side effects that we know come from the vaccine. This seems entirely reasonable to me. To him, that's crazy, and he has to portray it as right-wing media is just saying everyone is dying all of the time from the vaccine. Well, the people that are dying, what are they dying of? Is the vaccine an option? Yes. Oh, interesting. And would we know it was the vaccine? Would our media outlets be rushing to report that it was the vaccine? Would the medical industry be willing to admit that it was the vaccine? No? Okay, so it seems like supposition. It seems like guesses. It seems like estimations are all that we have because the professionals that would be tracking this sort of thing have no interest in doing so. So he thinks that's ridiculous, that we see a trend completely unprecedented, unrecognized in human life of young people dying. We say, gee, this looks an awful lot like vaccine side effects. Maybe we should look into this. That's ridiculous to him, but it's perfectly reasonable to him that without the vaccine, he would have died. These people, let's go back.
So many studies out there, you know, listen, you could, and as you know this, you can get COVID if you're vaccinated. It didn't give you a lesser chance of getting infected or giving it to somebody else.
Because it's not
However,
a vaccine.
You are, in so many studies that I've seen, and you can tell me if you disagree, far less likely to get the effects of having to go into the ICU or possibly dying if you were vaccinated. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're wrong. And here's the reason why. The prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials of the vaccines never showed a reduction in severity. They never showed a reduction in hospitalization and death. And what's come out over time is the virus has mutated to become a much milder virus. So as the vaccines were rolling out, you know, we were being confronted with a less mild virus. The other thing, I mean, a less severe virus, more mild. The other thing that happened is we learned how to treat the illness. Mm-hmm. So we treated patients early and we avoided hospitalization and death. So the two major things that save people's lives were having natural immunity from the first round of infection and then early treatment.
All right, we're going to go back to this vaccine on the other side, but I do love Brian Shapiro's face when Dr. Peter McCullough is like, yeah, the double-blind study never showed a reduction in severity. He's just like, really? Because that's all we have left. That's what I'm grasping to. That's not true? All right, welcome back, folks. In case you forgot, in case you needed to be reminded, the vaccine has never worked, and everything they've said about it has been a lie, and it went from 100% effective in preventing you from getting the virus and preventing you from spreading the virus to actually doesn't prevent you from getting the virus at all, and actually doesn't prevent you from spreading the virus at all. Actually, we can have vaccine-enhanced antibody reactions so that you're not coming down with the symptoms of the virus, but you are carrying it, meaning that you're spreading it to more people, you know, sort of unaware, and also allowing it to morph and mutate and perhaps get more powerful. We think that's where the Delta and Omicron variants came from. But eventually, after all of their lies and unfounded claims about the vaccine were disproven, what they were left with was the unfalsifiable claim that it made the virus less severe. There's no proof for that. It's impossible to have proof for that unless you had a time machine and could create two timelines, one in which the person got the disease with the virus, with the vaccine, and one without, and could compare the outcomes. It is an impossible claim to prove or disprove. But that's what they're clinging on to. That is the final claim of the vaccine lovers, that they, you know, And again, I mean, they were just as certain that the virus stopped, or the vaccine stopped the virus. They were just as confident about that. Of course, that was completely wrong. Well, they're extremely confident that it makes the virus less severe, but there's no way to prove or disprove it, so they're just going to keep being that confident. And again, it's fun to see Brian Shapiro, who is just, he would bet his life on the effectiveness of the vaccine, being presented very calmly by Dr. McCullough, the proof that everything he thinks and believes is wrong. Peter McCullough says, yeah, every double-blind study that's been done has failed to show any efficacy in diminution of effect of the virus. Brian Shapiro on Pushing the Limits podcast asked how many deaths occurred after COVID-19 vaccinations. Moderna, Texas recorded 17,751 vaccine deaths reported to by doctors, healthcare, regulatory personnel who concluded the vaccine was the cause of death. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And McCullough gets into this a little bit as well. And again, it's the one thing you're clinging on to turns out not to be true. What are you left with? A vaccine that does at best nothing, at worst has killed tens of thousands of people and still did nothing to stop the virus. So let's go back now to this video, and I'll get into some other numbers and some other developments that make this story particularly pertinent today. And in the next hour, we'll get into what Israel's doing and the threats to free speech and the way that Trump is being persecuted in a just unacceptable, untenable, egregious sort of way. But let's go back to this video now and stick to COVID for the moment, because as much as our border is open and our government occupied and our people being oppressed and our democracy being destroyed in front of our eyes, we have yet to deal with the wholesale genocide that was the vaccine program, the 1-2 punch, the binary weapon system of COVID-19 being created in a lab and released on purpose, and the vaccine, which killed God knows how many people and did nothing to stop it. So that crime has still gone unpunished. That crime against humanity has still gone unpunished, and the tyrants who put us in that position and the government agents that wielded these weapons are still walking around and not treated in the Nuremberg-style justice that they deserve. So here's Dr. Peter McCullough again, just raining on this dummies parade. Let's watch.
Remember, the vaccines came in late, you know, so we're already a year in the pandemic. We've been treating people for a year. Mm-hmm. The vaccines come in late. And in a recent paper by Norman Fenton from the UK, he's shown that there was tremendous misclassification bias. So when they declared that there was a epidemic of the unvaccinated, in fact, the hospitals weren't, you know, they had no idea who was vaccinated or not. They didn't have connection to the CDC vaccine records. They weren't going in the ICU and figuring out people on the ventilator who were vaccinated and who weren't. In countries that actually did have the vaccine status, like the UK, they found far more vaccinated in the hospital on ventilators and dying than the unvaccinated. And in a paper by Shretha and colleagues from the Cleveland Clinic, the lowest risk workers that they have in 51,000 workers are the unvaccinated. And with every single injection, one is more and more likely to get COVID-19. Now, the deaths that have been reported after the vaccine are unprecedented. Our safety system for vaccines records on average, half the country takes vaccines in the United States before COVID, records on average 150 deaths in a year on average. The COVID-19 vaccines roll out, and as we sit here today, our CDC has verified 18,655 Americans dying after the vaccine. 1,150 die on the same day they take the shot. Some die in the vaccine center. 1,200 die the next day. Now, that's underreported by a factor in FDA testimony of about 30. We're looking, as we sit here today, at 550,000 plus Americans have died after the vaccine. So pattern is seen worldwide. There are calls to pull these vaccines off the market. They're so grossly unsafe because people die quickly after taking them.
I don't mean to laugh. Nothing funny about people being browbeaten, being coerced, being threatened, cajoled, and blackmailed into taking a vaccine that kills them. But it is funny to watch a leftist's face when being confronted with this information. It is funny to watch their entire worldview be shattered right in front of them by a expert beyond criticism, beyond the slightest criticism. Because, you know, at InfoWars, myself personally, we're just like jacks of all trades, masters of none, right? We cover the vaccine stuff, but I got to cover Trump prosecution. I got to figure out what's going on in Israel. I got to try to cover all this other stuff. I don't have the, you know, information at hand like somebody like Peter McCullough does, who has one area of expertise that he is extremely well-schooled in. It's fun to see somebody like that take on one of these leftists who, you know, if it was me, I don't have the details. So I would have to rely on the argument that just like, look, the vaccines kill everybody. I don't know the details. I don't have all of the numbers in front of me. All I know is they didn't stop the virus and have killed tons of people. And then you got to go do the research. Pretend I'm, you know, act like what I'm saying is not true and go research it yourself. What you'll find is actually it is. But Dr. Peter McCullough has the stats, the numbers, the doctors that did the studies and the names of the studies and where they were carried out and how they were carried out and where they were published. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to see. God bless Dr. Peter McCullough. And again, this is important because the people that did this to us, the people that created this virus, allowed it to spread all over the world, and then introduced a fake vaccine that was in fact a designed kill shot, a soft kill weapon that has killed tens of thousands, are still out there and still planning their next move. Now, America is somehow behind the rest of the world on this. And in fact, there's a video that I just put in the folder. Thousands of Japanese have gathered. They gathered 3 days ago on April 13th to rally against the new WHO Global Health Treaty. And we can go to that video now. A17 News. Thousands rally against the WHO New World Order in Japan. So we got allies all over the globe. But these people are still trying to do it. The WHO is still trying to use COVID as an excuse to gain supranational control and destroy the sovereignty of nations on the basis of health. And so it's worth it to remind everybody, they failed utterly. They didn't just not succeed. I mean, you know, if you have a security guard at a bank, you know, not succeeding would be you allow the bank to be robbed. What is it called when like a bank robber shows up and the security guard tries to stop him, ends up killing four innocent people and lighting all of the money on fire? Like, is that just a failure or is that something else? Because that's what the WHO did, and they're still trying to gain international control with their pandemic treaty. So just a little quick reminder for all of our audience, the COVID pandemic may have subsided, and that just means it's time for the tribunals. That means it's time, or should at least be time, to try and punish the war criminals.
An absolutely indispensable tool that Congress can give us in our fight against foreign adversaries is the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It is critical in securing our nation, and we are in crunch time with our 702 authority set to expire next week. So let me be clear, failure to reauthorize 702 or gutting it with some new kind of warrant requirement would be dangerous and put Americans' lives at risk.
Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was enacted to make it easier for the government to address foreign terrorist threats. Targeting Americans is prohibited, but intelligence agencies have used Section 702 to spy on hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. And this week, it's looking to get a lot worse. Elizabeth Goitein of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice does a great job of explaining it and sounding the alarm. buried in the Section 702 reauthorization bill passed by the House on Friday, is the biggest expansion of domestic surveillance since the Patriot Act. Under current law, the government can compel electronic communication service providers that have direct access to communications to assist the NSA in conducting Section 702 surveillance. Companies like Verizon and Google must turn over the communications of targets, which officially must be foreigners overseas, but this has been abused to spy on Americans. By changing the definition of electronic communications surveillance provider, an amendment offered by House Intel Committee leaders and passed by the House vastly expands the universe of entities that can be compelled to assist the NSA. If the bill becomes law, any company or individual that provides any service whatsoever may be forced to assist in NSA surveillance, as long as they have access to equipment on which communications are transmitted or stored. When the amendment was first unveiled, civil liberties advocates noted that the provision would encompass hotels, libraries, and coffee shops, and so they were excluded. But the vast majority of U.S. businesses remain fair game, including barbershops, laundromats, fitness centers, hardware stores, and any small business that provides Wi-Fi to their customers via routers. It also includes commercial landlords that rent out offices, which would target journalists, lawyers, financial advisors, healthcare providers, and anyone renting commercial office space. The amendment even includes service providers who come into our homes, such as house cleaners, plumbers, and IT service providers, all of whom could be forced to serve as surrogate spies and be required to give the NSA direct access. And none of them would be allowed to tell anyone. They would be under a gag order and would face heavy penalties if they failed to comply. Having wholesale access to domestic communications, the NSA would then be on the honor system to retain only the communications of approved foreign targets. And we know from past experience that they cannot be trusted to do this. The Senate is scheduled to vote on the bill this week. Section 702 expires on April 19th, but the Biden administration has obtained FISA court approval to continue Section 702 surveillance until April of 2025. Call your senators now and tell them to block the Everyone is a Spy surveillance bill. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
All right, folks, you can finance, share that video as always at band.video end 702. Remember, hit the download button, upload it yourself. Hit the share button, it gives you that disguised link. We rely on you. You are the power of InfoWars. Without you spreading this message, spreading the link, spreading the videos, and going to InfoWarsStore.com, well, then we're just shouting into the wilderness. We rely on you, and we thank you for your participation in this information war. We'll be back on the other side. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the American Journal, InfoWars.com, band.video. We'll be joined in the next hour by Ian Carroll of Cancel This Clothing Company. Even if you don't know his name, you'll probably recognize his face as he has dominated the online conspiracy sphere recently with his very powerful investigations into things like BlackRock. He, like me, discovered the Eagle 2 document and went on vacation in the rabbit hole for a little while. And I can't tell you how excited I am about this. For 4 years, I have been trying to get people to pay attention to this document. It's like Christmas and Easter all rolled into one when I saw that Ian Carroll had discovered this and was making a big deal out of it. And I was talking to him on DMs when we're both just like, how does nobody care about this? Why does this not have more attention? So we're going to force people to pay attention to it. I'm just very excited to talk about this. One of my favorite topics ever. But before then, we've got war, we've got persecution, we've got Trump on trial, we've got children being subjected to mysterious medical intervention at their schools. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But let's talk now about Israel and Iran as the world waits with bated breath to find out what Israel does next. What did they do next? Israel has vowed to respond to the unprecedented Iranian missile and drone attack, raising concerns of a regional war. Axios reports the Biden administration and several other Western countries allied with Israel are urging Benjamin Netanyahu's government to exercise caution and avoid rushing into a retaliation against Iran that could lead to a regional war. Which is interesting because, of course, the attack by Iran was itself a retaliation against the attack of on the consulate in Damascus, the Iranian consulate that was bombed by Israel. But it seems like history always begins with the retribution. Seems like in the telling of events, it always starts with the backlash, but it's never presented as backlash. So where this goes is really at this point entirely up to Israel, as America seems completely unwilling to step in and force them to chill out a little bit. Again, this could have been prevented at any point in the past by restricting Israeli activity, even a moderate degree. But of course, the American government is either impotent to stop them or unwilling to try, and is now scrambling to save face and project strength despite the obvious and repeated humiliations that Israel is subjecting them to. We can go now to clip number 11 as John Kirby, who is like the definition of a sleazebag. He is like so good at what he does. Like I'm not, he's no Karine Jean-Pierre, okay? I know it can be cliche to say everybody in the Biden administration, everybody in the government is incompetent and stupid and whatever. They're not. She is. I mean, Karine Jean-Pierre is not good at what she does. She could take some lessons from somebody like John Kirby, who is unflappable and is able to project with confidence just blatant, ridiculous lies. That is his skill. And so we're going to watch that skill on display here. And even somebody as skilled at this rhetorical trickery as John Kirby is, it doesn't really work when you look at the facts behind what he's saying. Let's go first to Peter Doocy questioning John Kirby about Biden's very, strident demand to Iran that was completely ignored within 24 hours. Let's watch.
John, has President Biden considered maybe beefing up the public Iran posture to be more than just one word?
You're referring to don't.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about...
And they did it anyway.
And let's talk about what we did, Peter. Let's talk about don't and did. Let's talk about Saturday night. He made it clear that he didn't want to see escalation in the region.
And
let me finish. He added military resources to the region right after October 7th. And then when we had an inkling that this kind of thing was coming, he added even more military resources to the region. More destroyers that were capable of shooting down ballistic missiles, a fighter squadron that was able to shoot down drones. And that's what we did. So you can talk about the don't word all you want, but let's talk about what did happen. And what did happen was Iran utterly failed. And if I'm sitting in Tehran right now, I'm betting that President Biden takes it pretty seriously when he says, don't escalate. He's going to act to make sure that you can. And they didn't. Yes, they fired an unprecedented amount of munitions. But how much of a success did they have, Peter? None. Zero. Very little infrastructure. It was an embarrassing failure for the Supreme Leader for the IRGC.
It's just funny to me because obviously, it's just Biden obviously failed. He obviously failed in stopping Iran from doing anything, right? And he really can't even dance around that. Biden's like, don't do anything. And sure, Iran then immediately launched an unprecedented number of missiles, but I mean, who cares? It's like, okay, all right. So clearly, the intimidation of President Joe Biden, not exactly having the effect that one would want the words of a president of the United States to have. So that's embarrassing. But then the only way that he can sort of make up for it is to like mock Iran and be like, they didn't achieve anything. And it's like, stop, John, what are you doing? What do you want to like push them into doing more? You think they couldn't do more? You know, they warned Turkey, who then warned its, you know, intelligence allies that this was coming. Everybody knew it was coming. They basically announced as the drones and missiles were on their way, okay, here's, we launched them here. They're going here. Try to intercept them. And then they did. It was symbolic, as we mentioned. Now, I said it yesterday, but bears repeating. This was a minuscule attack. This was nothing. It was symbolic. You know, they have to do something to get retribution for what was done to them. It was unprecedented in the fact that Iran has never launched missiles from its own territory. It outsources its activities to the Houthis and Hezbollah and others. But I remind you again, 300 missiles is nothing compared to even just the missile caches that Hezbollah has or the Houthis have, let alone the state of Israel. It could hit Iran with 100 times that many missiles, and it wouldn't even, you know, make a dent in their stockpiles. So do you really want to taunt them? Is that really the smartest move, Mr. Kirby? You think they couldn't have destroyed some Israeli infrastructure if they wanted to? They're actually not trying to, you know, have this expand into a wider regional conflict. I can't say the same about Israel. So it's just funny that he starts like taunting Iran at the end there. Which, you know, thankfully, Iran seems more mature than our ruling class. Seems like if it was our ruling class, that type of, you know, mocking, prodding. If Iran was ruled by children like we are, probably like, oh, you thought we couldn't get infrastructure? All right, now we're going to show you what we can do. We're going to shut you up. And of course, it's not just the don't aimed at Iran that has been ignored. For the last 6 months, we have been sending people to Israel with that exact message. Don't. Don't bomb this area. Don't continue the saturation bombing. Don't kill innocent civilians. Don't bomb aid workers. Every single one of these don'ts has been completely ignored by our allies, let alone our enemies. So America's ability to impact the actions of foreign states is being embarrassingly eviscerated in real time. And that's part of what Bill Hemmer from Fox News says to John Kirby in clip number one. We can go to that now.
Hands full. And I was looking back at the track record for President Biden. Here's what sticks out. The Afghanistan withdrawal was a mess. We failed to stop Putin from going into Ukraine. The war with Israel and Hamas has been absolutely dreadful and destructive. Again, it's the first time Iran has aimed at Israel. China's military buildup is substantial. And that was just this morning what I came up with. Can you argue that American strength and persuasion is better today than it was 4 years ago globally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100% I can, Bill, and I can do that very comfortably after serving for as long as I did in uniform. I'll tell you, this is a president who understands American leadership on the world stage. He has devoted additional resources, not just militarily, but diplomatically, economically, around the world to advance our national security interests.
Diplomatically, economically. Well, what he means by that is that Biden has attempted to bribe other countries into not doing the things that they end up doing anyway with the money that he gives them. That's what he means economically, diplomatically. So economically, the attempts to stop Russia completely backfired, and Russia's doing better than ever. But also we've been spending hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of billions, actually, I should say, in an attempt to, you know, coerce other countries into being on our side. And it's had, you know, some degree of success, but as the list Bill Hemmer lays out, not exactly a grade A for the Biden administration geopolitically. But that's not even mentioning the real threats to our actual security. You know, he says this doesn't have, you know, quite the, you know, this isn't quite the security success that we'd expect it to be. But none of these things actually have to do with our success or with our security, I should say. the Afghanistan withdrawal was absolutely horrifically disastrous, but Afghanistan was never really a threat to us anyway. Russia was never really a threat to us in Ukraine. Iran is not really a threat to us outside of the Middle East, where our bases surround that country. So none of these things actually impact actual American security. They just impact the security of our interest overseas and our, you know, wait, John Kirby blames Trump for emboldening Iran. Okay. As Biden weathers storm over don't foreign policy. Yeah, I'm sure it was Trump's fault, definitely. But what about the open border? What about the terrorists that are literally released? What about the average person walking down the street and getting their brains bashed in by somebody who's been arrested 9 times in 10 years and let out every single time? What about the story after story that we see every single day of things like this? Accused NYC subway slasher busted for stabbing 1-year-old boy in Philly just days after skipping court date. A Brooklyn woman charged in a subway stabbing that left a Good Samaritan injured was busted for knifing 2 people in Philadelphia, including a 1-year-old boy, just days after skipping out on a court date in her New York City case. Again, depends on how you define national security, but it seems to me like the Democrats and the Black Lives Matter activists and the people pushing for bail reform and reimagining the justice system are a bigger threat to my personal safety than anybody in Afghanistan ever, anybody in Russia ever, or anybody in Iran ever. But those people could be making their way across our border as we speak, as tens of thousands of Chinese certainly are. What about the weather balloon that China sent across the entirety of the United States, systematically eavesdropping over our most sensitive military sites? What about just any number of other unnamed, like from that list, Bill Hemmer said, like, this is just off the top of my head. Well, he missed a lot. He missed a lot of major national security faux pas in the Biden administration so far. Just dismal. Dismal would be the grade I would give to Joe Biden's security. None of these things happened under Trump. Russia didn't invade Ukraine under Trump. Iran didn't attack Israel under Trump. Israel didn't attack Gaza under Trump. None of this happened under Trump, because he actually understood peace through strength, and the comparison is shocking in its difference between the two styles, Joe Biden and President Trump. Now, Americans might be confused on this because their coverage of the Israel conflict is warped beyond recognition by the media outlets themselves. As we've covered before, CNN themselves have admitted that any news that they report on Israel first has to pass through a censor from the Israeli government. So the Israeli government is actively censoring some of the most popular or prominent voices in American media. So we're not getting the full picture there. And this story from The Intercept today says, leaked New York Times Gaza memo tells journalists to avoid words genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. New York Times instructed journalists covering Israel's war in the Gaza Strip to restrict the use of the terms genocide, ethnic cleansing, to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land, according to a copy of an internal memo obtained by The Intercept. The memo also includes instructions to reporters not to use the word Palestine, except in very rare cases, and to steer clear of the term refugee camps to describe areas of Gaza historically settled by displaced Palestinians expelled from other parts of Palestine during previous Israel-Arab wars. The areas are recognized by the United Nations as refugee camps and house hundreds of thousands of registered refugees, but you're not allowed to call them that. So again, you've got, you know, a million South Americans waltzing into America with, you know, credit cards given to them by the UN. They're called refugees. People living in tents, having been expelled from their homes just ahead of those homes being bombed to rubble, those are not to be called refugees. This is the way language is manipulated, not to outright lie, but to just warp the truth a little bit, just to make it not quite as bad sounding as it is.
To subtly persuade you.
Subtle persuasion. It is so. That's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just all just ridiculous. It is also unsustainable. This is unsustainable, is what it is. Something's got to give. And I, again, would really like to see. I mean, maybe this is the chance for a third party that's just the not Israel party. Or again, maybe there's a pledge that people can take to not take AIPAC money. And the trick of this, the secret to this, is make things like AIPAC so unpopular that signing a anti-AIPAC pledge is more beneficial than the money that AIPAC offers you. When dealing with this democracy that we live in, it's a transactional sort of situation where politicians will have to decide whether taking $100,000 from the Israel lobby is really worth it when not taking that money, is taking that money worth it when taking that money means that there's a huge portion of Americans that have vowed not to vote for them. So if we get people to, and this is actually what Rush Limbaugh did in 1992, when he got politicians to sign a pledge to not increase taxes or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it became a major driver in that election. And you had Republicans basically scrambling to sign this pledge and to go along with this, knowing what a electoral benefit it would be. Maybe now's the time for something like that, but with AIPAC. And a Democrat, Republican, I think this is a cross-party issue. It's not about red versus blue. It's about those in charge versus everybody else in America who is absolutely sick of this crap. Now, time to go to clip number two. This is from the UK. David Cameron tries to justify Israel's attack on Iran consulate while simultaneously condemning Iran's response. Watch the cognitive dissonance display itself in real time. Let's go to clip number two now.
Is it bad judgment or good judgment to hit Iranian sovereign territory in Damascus?
That's something the Israelis decided to do. We haven't made a... I'll answer the question, which is I can completely understand the frustration the Israelis feel when they look at the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and they look at the terrible things that they have done all over the world, including the support they give to Hamas. And, of course, Hamas were responsible for October the 7th, and that is where all of this begins. So you can completely understand the frustration.
Yeah, but what about Iran's frustration at part of its sovereign territory being flattened?
Well, I would argue there is a massive degree of difference between what Israel did in Damascus and, as I said, 301 weapons being launched by Iran at the state of Israel. For the first time, a state-on-state attack. 101 ballistic missiles, 36 cruise missiles, 185 drones. That is a degree of difference.
Yeah.
And I think a reckless and dangerous thing for Iran to have done. And I think the whole world can see all these countries that have somehow wondered, well, you know, what is the true nature of Iran? It's there, okay, in black and white.
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, you know, we would take the very strong action.
Yeah, kind of like Iran did. Interesting. And it's amazing how he can make statements like, you know, this is the first time that Israel and Iran attacked each other's sovereign territory. Right, except for the consulate attack that you were just asked about. Right, except for that. Except for the thing that we just asked you about, you're right. But there is that thing, so I guess you're wrong. I guess that's incorrect, and you know it. Why Western leaders twist themselves in a knot to serve Israel? Well, let's just say there's probably a video with David Cameron with a pig out there somewhere on the Mossad hard drives. Israel's war cabinet was set to meet for the third time in 3 days on Tuesday to decide a response to Iran's first ever direct attack amid international pressure to avoid further escalating the conflicts in the Middle East. Yeah, it's okay. While the attack caused no deaths and little damage thanks to the air defenses and countermeasures of Israel and its allies, it has increased concerns that violence rooted in the Gaza war is spreading and fears of open war between the longtime foes. Iran launched the attack in retaliation for an airstrike on its embassy compound in Damascus on the 1st of April, attributed to Israel, but signaled that it did not seek further escalation. So, well, again, it's just entirely up to Israel, I guess. And knowing their track record, I expect World War III to break out any minute now. I expect them to do something reckless and dangerous and suicidal and then demand that America protect them, and America will dutifully do so. It's absolutely ridiculous. When we come back on the other side, we'll relate this a little bit to what's happening in Ukraine and tell you one way you can prepare for the seemingly inevitable World War conflict. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We've been reporting for years about the fault lines being drawn for World War III. It's been obvious to anybody paying attention, but now it's really getting solidified and codified and officialized. As the Spectator Index reports, the Washington Post reports that ties between Russia and Iran have now included a pledge by Moscow to provide the Iranians with advanced fighter jets and air defense technology that, quote, could help Tehran harden its defenses against any future airstrike by Israel or the United States. So, Iran and Russia increasing their military cooperation. So, I think the fault lines are pretty much being drawn. It is NATO, America, and Israel versus Russia, Iran, China, and all of their allies. I already don't feel like the good guys. But then again, it doesn't really matter which side you're on. World War serves nobody's interest except the evil people who will benefit no matter who comes out on top during the fighting. I want to go to another video here. That has to do with our support for Ukraine and the unimaginable amount of money that we've spent on that complete boondoggle, that utterly pointless, entirely avoidable tragedy that continues to scar Central Eastern Europe. Here's a video just talking about what we could have gotten with the money that we've spent to kill a bunch of Ukrainian people for no particular reason. Let's watch.
Check this out. With the $165 billion we gave to Ukraine, we could have built 6 border walls to stop illegal immigrants from pouring across our southern border, could have fixed Flint's water system 215 times over.
Easily.
I like this one. Could have given every homeless vet $2 million.
Holy shit.
Could have given $50 million to every family impacted by the Maui wildfires.
And they got $700. They got $700 each.
We got to get our priorities straight, buddy.
According to HUD, they think it would take $20 billion to end homelessness in America. $20 billion. And what'd you say? We've sent 100 and how much? We could have ended...
$165 billion.
So we could have ended homelessness 8 times over in America. Yeah, bro. It's outrageous.
Our priorities are...
It's outrageous.
And what we got instead was nothing. No, we got actually... We've gotten less than nothing, right? We've been actually hugely damaged by our participation in Ukraine. We've done nothing but empower Russia with our economic sanctions. And yet they're still doing it. And yet there's no end in sight. And yet now we're having a situation in Congress where the Republicans are passing a Israel bill, the Democrats are passing a Ukraine bill. Everybody gets what they want except for the American people, who should theoretically be the only concern of the people in power. That's not exactly how it's working out, though, is it? Now, on this note, I actually want to go to clip number 10 here. Just quick update on the Lahaina Maui fire aftermath, because as we know, It's been about 8 months since that mysterious fire in Maui. And not a lot has happened. Not a lot of help has gone to the people affected by this. Again, just think about how America treats its own citizens compared to what it's willing to dish out by the billions for everybody that's not American. Let's go now to clip number 10.
Aloha from Lahaina, Maui. April 13th, 2024. Update. The Army Corps of Engineers have cleaned the toxic debris from around 500 homes so far. The sad thing is that no building permits have been issued at all after 8 months. Nobody's allowed to rebuild. Now compare that to Hurricane Iniki on the island of Kauai in 1994. Building permits were issued 1 month after the hurricane. I know hurricane and fires are different, but still, why is it taking so long for people to be rebuilding? That's the update, guys. It's very sad that people can't rebuild and everything is taking so long. You wonder why? I'm just reporting, guys. Another sad news is that all the fire victims staying in hotels right now, there's still thousands of them, have to move out by July 1st. Where are they gonna go? There's no housing in Maui. It's a nightmare. If you wanna help, check the bio. Check my link in my bio, guys. Thank you so much. Aloha.
Yeah, absolutely nothing for the American people, but endless money available for everybody else. Yeah, tragic isn't exactly the right word for it, because that implies maybe it's accidental or something like that. No, this is very deliberate and heartbreaking. Speaking of, we're gonna show you some other pretty disturbing stuff on the other side when it has to do with kids' medical interventions by their schools. But, you know, whether it's World War III or a wildfire or a hurricane, it doesn't hurt to be prepared. And InfoWars.com, InfoWarsStore.com can help you get prepared. We actually have a new emergency sale. It's the Globalist Destabilization Emergency Sale. You're getting 10% off all storable foods and water filtration. The globalists have crept out of the shadows and are now openly trying to destabilize the entire planet. In my opinion, now is the most crucial time to stock up on storable food and get ready for the next big crisis, because these leftists have already shown they are not holding anything back. In response to the leftist sabotage of humanity, the team over at My Patriot Supply have agreed to allow us to offer our customers 10% off all storable food and water filtration. But this deal cannot last long. It's only available for a limited time exclusively at InfoWarsStore.com. It's been years since we've had to raise prices on storable foods, something that we have had to do now multiple times in just the past few years as a result of the globalist planned chaos. And that's why it's important that you take advantage of the savings on our high-quality storable food before we're forced to raise the price yet again. Your decision now can mean save time and money and possibly lives later. Again, maybe you don't think World War III is going to break out. Maybe you don't think you have anything to worry about. Well, there's always earthquakes. There's always hurricanes. There's always wildfires or electricity shutdowns. There's a variety of different things that it simply pays to be prepared for. And it's really, it's a win-win. Like, talk about a 360 win. If you buy storable food, either you have a food supply there for you, if in the worst case scenario, it's necessary. And if not, then you have delicious food to eat anytime in the next 20 years. And it actually is delicious. I don't know if we're still airing the taste testing commercial that we did a couple years ago, but I was not acting. I was not acting. The food in My Patriot Supply is actually better than store-bought food. The macaroni that I got out of the blue box was trash compared to the delicious food from My Patriot Supply. So, like, what you're getting here is not dehydrated corn husks that you can technically survive on. It's like actually good, delicious, pre-prepared food that lasts for 20 years and can be accessed at any time that you maybe don't feel like going to the grocery store and just want to eat a good meal that takes like 2 minutes to prepare. It really is incredible stuff. Again, it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And once the catastrophe happens, well, it's too late at that point. So don't leave yourself in a position where you're sitting there going, gee, I probably should have gotten that storable food now that I'm starving and everywhere's closed. Gosh, I sure wish I'd taken advantage of that sale now that I'm, you know, digging through my pantry for whatever grains are left. Just don't put yourself in that position. Just act now, get the storable food, put it away, and if you never need to access it, then what a blessing, what a great thing that would be. But if you do need it, it's better to have it. InfoWarsStore.com, 10% off the Globalist Destabilization Emergency Sale. All right, welcome back, folks. We're going to go to a video now that was posted by Libs of TikTok that I'm struggling to justify. I'm struggling to figure out what exactly is going on here. Let's just go ahead and go to this video, and we'll talk about it on the other side. This video from a mother in southern Kentucky whose school is engaged in some very suspicious activity when it comes to medical care of the students in their charge. Let's go down to this video, and we'll see if we can't figure out what this is really all about on the other side.
So where are all of my parents that have kids in grade school, like first through fifth grade? Because I have a question for you. Down here in southeastern Kentucky, they offer programs for children who don't have access to health care, especially for like dental work. And they sent a consent form home saying that they were selecting the grades and that your kid could get a free cleaning done for the service that they offer. They have a dentist come out on this big tour bus and they do the free cleanings. And I was like, okay, whatever. Well, they sent home a piece of paper in the mail saying that my kids, both of my kids who are in first grade, have abnormalities and that I would have to consent for them to do further treatment. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, my kids go to the dentist on a regular basis, like every 6 months to a year. Like, there's never no cavities, decaying. Their baby teeth are coming out, so their teeth are loose, but that's it. So I call the school. They tell me, we have no control over that. You have to wait until the dentist call you. This lady calls me and she's going over the stuff that's wrong. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense how my kids' teeth, like from the last 6 months, are suddenly decaying and that they're going to need root canals and like all this kind of crap. Well, then she's like, well, we're going to send home consent forms. I just need you to sign it, put your insurance on it. And she was like, once the procedures are done, she's like, it's going to be done over a consecutive amount of days. But she was like, your kids are going to have to miss school for this, and we're going to have to put them under that laughing gas anesthesia, but you are not allowed to be there. We'll just call you whenever it's time to pick them up. And I was like, no. I was like, I'm going to contact their dentist because this does not seem right. They have an appointment literally in like 2 months. Like, I'm going to get this taken care of. Take my kids to the dentist. Nothing is wrong with my children. They both have baby teeth that they're losing, but there's no sign of cavities, no signs of decaying, nothing. The dentist showed me the scans. So tell me why a couple days ago I get a call back from that school dentist telling me, oh, well, we understand that we didn't get your consent form, but your child is scheduled for a surgery for this, this, and this day, and then your other child is going to be on this, this, and this day, so we can separate it up in weeks. And she was like, we're just going to go ahead and do it since you already signed the first cleaning consent form, and then we'll call you and let you know. And I said, no, you're not touching my kids. And she's like, well, what are you talking about? She's like, don't you care about the priority of your kids? Because it looks like your kids never brush their teeth. And I was like, ma'am, I just took my kids to their dentist and they had a clean bill of health. I asked to see the records. I asked to see where they, you know, the exams of the teeth decaying and cavities. They refused to show me anything. But she was so concerned with it. She was like, all we need is your insurance information. But she was like, we are going to have to put your kids asleep and they are going to miss this amount of school. And I was like, no. I was like, I'm not opting into anything. You're not touching my kids. So tell me why I get a letter sent home to me from the school board telling me that the days that the dentist had my kids scheduled, if they missed that amount of days, my kids would be in truancy and I would have to go to court. Like, somebody make it make sense. Like, I'm not understanding. I feel like that dentist was just trying to rack up on my insurance and trying to put my kids through unnecessary, like, dental work, and especially putting them to sleep knowing that I'm not allowed to be there. Like, I've never even been allowed to talk to the dentist. So can somebody make this make sense? Like, am I hallucinating or what would you do?
So what's that about? What's up with that? Really deeply disturbing stuff. I mean, so many things wrong about this, right? The fact that they say by signing a release to allow your kids' teeth to get cleaned, now they can put them under and do surgery without you even there? What? That's outrageous. The fact that they want to do surgery alone, outrageous. The fact that they would do it without allowing the parent there, completely outrageous. And you have to wonder how many parents aren't as good as this mother. Like, clearly this mom has everything under control, is very involved in what her kids are doing and everything, and, you know, is up to date on all their, you know, dental visits and everything. Like, it's kind of, it's out of all the things that deal with kids' health, their teeth is like the least of anyone's concern. I mean, they're children's teeth, right? They fall out eventually. Getting little kids to brush their teeth is always a pain in the butt. And I imagine there's a lot of parents out there that if they were to get a call like this from their school saying, your kid's teeth are rotten, they might either not know any better or kind of feel guilty, like, ah, gee, I really haven't been doing as good of a job as I should in making sure that they go to the dentist all the time, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, and that guilt can be a persuasive technique. Just get them to go, oh, yeah, that's fine. I can do that. Sure, go ahead. Like, how many parents would not even know this was going on and just agree to whatever it is that the experts and the doctors say? I mean, is this just an insurance scam? Is that all this is? Or is it something significantly worse? I think all speculation is valid at this point because so far I have no real reason why they would be doing this, why they would be taking kids with perfectly healthy teeth and demanding that they be subjected to laughing gas surgery when it's totally unnecessary. I mean, this is like beyond criminal. This is creepy. Very weird. And of course, the real danger of this is that you now have official documents saying that your children are, you know, compromised in their health. They're not getting the care that they need. If you refuse to let them do surgery on your kids without you present, like if you refuse that, are they going to turn you over to CPS? Or are they going to say that you are negligent and that for the sake of your children, they need to be taken away from you? Like, where does this go next? Where does this end? Why is this allowed to happen at all? So if nothing else, this is the warning to other parents to not sign the dental permission form that your kids bring home from school. Just avoid this whole issue entirely. Again, I guess this is the way that it works, right? You offer up something that is seemingly free and valuable and important for your kids, especially too if you're a lower income school district where people would be happy. Hey, I can't afford a, you know, elective teeth cleaning from the dentist. So yeah, let the school do it. That's great. You sign the paper thinking you're getting something from daddy government, only to learn that that was just the foot in the door they needed to then exploit you, possibly take your kids away. I don't think that's too far-fetched, considering all of the things that we know the school district and the medical industry is engaged in. So I'm scrolling through the thread from Libs of TikTok looking for, you know, reasons why they would be doing this, what's actually behind this. Nobody seems to know. Jennifer McWilliams says mobile dentists have been visiting schools for years, and yes, it's all about the money. As schools build out, quote, community schools model, the services will expand from dentistry to medical services such as birth control, hormone blockers, etc., which are part of the wraparound services. Again, I haven't actually studied that. I just saw this video just dropped a few minutes ago. Sarah Fields is the reporter who first broke this story at Sarah is Censored. She's a friend of the show and a great researcher. But nobody else has any, I mean, there's a lot of speculation, but nobody else is just saying the same thing I am. What the hell? Why the heck would a school ever schedule an appointment for a student, let alone without the parent knowing about it? This is clearly a scam, and the faculty behind it need to be fired. Using kids as pawns like this is child abuse. Insurance scam maybe, but they want to anesthetize her kids without parents being present? Sounds like child exploitation to me. No, you're not allowed to be there. We'll just call you when it's time to pick them up. Nope, huge red flag. Any parent who hears this should instantly be on alert and not leave your kids with anyone who says that this mom has good instincts. Again, the question is, what about mothers who either don't have these good instincts or are so busy with a second job that they don't have time to look into the particulars of what's going on with their kids? For parents who, again, feel guilty that maybe they haven't been as diligent as they should about their kids' teeth? Just what the hell is going on in this country, man? We'll be back on the other side with Ian Carroll. Very excited for the interview in the next hour.
Welcome to the Ted Kennedy Files about Robert Ferreira and the Five Star Trust. We're about to go down a long rabbit hole that more or less centers around a series of bank accounts that the CIA has been using to launder drug money and a lot of other illegal funds for the purposes of black operations through the 70s, 80s, 90s, maybe 2000s, because these black budget operations need funding that is not on the books, and they need to, and a lot of them are not approved by Congress, which it explicitly states. And so it's funds that are garnered through illegal means, laundered through companies that don't exist, to accounts that don't exist, under fronts of people that have no association with the CIA, to fund operations that don't exist. That's the context of what all that we're talking about here is. And it ties into a lot of things. It ties into like a lot of reporting by Whitney Webb. If you've read her books, this is all the same underlying stuff behind it. So depending on what you already know about this time frame, you're going to have a bunch of interesting connections that'll go off in your head. And I've got a million different questions and connections that I want to research in regards to it, but you know, one thing at a time. So I'm going to do my best to skim through this story without getting too lost in the weeds of it, but with providing enough context to keep us all on track here. And I think the way I'm going to do it, assuming that we can get this big enough, is I'm going to show you my notes in my note-taking app, because I've added a lot of context in here too. So without further ado, let's get into it. If you're not familiar, Senator Edward Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, he's one of the longest running senators in U.S. history. I think he had the third longest tenure of any senator. He's of the Kennedy clan. He's of the generation above RFK, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. He had a long and complex life. He was going to run for president, and then there was this mysterious incident back in, I think, 69, where he drove a car off a bridge with a woman in it when they might have been high and drunk, and she died and drowned, and he left the scene, and it's a whole thing. I think it's called Chapadwick. And you should look that up if you want a mystery to solve. Let's just say that there's some sus stuff in Ted's background. But around 1989, much of this story focuses around 1989. A lot of these documents were all written in 1989. A lot of this plot converged and then redispersed in 1989. 1989 is going to come up over and over and over. And in 1989, Teddy Boy started to get really interested in things that he wasn't supposed to be asking about. In particular, he asked his friend at the FBI to write a report of everything that they could find. He wanted them to go through all their files and write up a full report of everything you know about this guy named Major General Robert L. Ferreira. And this following report is everything that his FBI contact was able to glean about the history of Robert Ferreira and all associated operations. For all intents and purposes, Robert Ferreira is Jason Bourne. He is the spy of all spies. We're going to have an opinion of Robert Ferreira by the end of this, but just roll with it for a bit. And just remember that no matter how unbelievable this document sounds at certain times, I'm going to show you a lot of corroborative evidence from other documents, things that we can verify today online, unrelated to the documents that seem to corroborate it. So per your oral request of June 5th, 1989, requesting a full report on the Japanese, Singapore, New Zealand, Kentucky connection, what follows is as complete and thorough an investigation of any and all available files of the Bureau, as well as any top secret, confidential, or personal files from the Department of Defense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just remembered too, before we get too deep into this, you guys can find these files. I have put them online. The file I'm reading right now, I went back to try to find its original source and I couldn't find where I found it on archive.org, so I re-uploaded it.
Joined this hour by Ian Carroll, based textile merchant. He's the founder and a content creator behind Cancel This Clothing Company. You can follow him on X at Cancel Clo Co. That's Cancel C-L-O-C-O. On Rumble at Cancel This Conspiracy. And you can snag some new threads over at CancelThisClothingCompany.com. Again, it's Cancel This Conspiracy on Rumble, CancelThisClothingCompany.com, and on X at Cancel Clo Co. Ian Carroll, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Harrison. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And of course, if people have spent any time on the internet in the recent past, they've probably seen your face. You have really dominated the conspiracy sphere recently because of your incredible research into BlackRock and, you know, just following the money. But you discovered a document that I discovered about 4 years ago. I call it the Eagle 2 document. You call it the Five-Star Trust. And I just cannot tell you how thrilled I am that somebody else has discovered this document and has done the research you've done into it. How did you find this document?
You know, I'm not entirely sure how I found this document. It was in the course of digging through other, like, CIA history Google searches. And I get deeper and deeper and deeper on the Google searches. And at one point, the FBI report came up on archive.org. And so I had no context when I found that report. And then the whole rest of my investigation was basically me trying to corroborate, because the report is so mind-blowing and unbelievable that when I found it as a solo document, I was almost skeptical that it was even real, because it is unreal.
Yeah.
And I've obviously corroborated that it is definitely real.
I know everything in it can be corroborated, and this is the thing. And so people are interested about the details of this document. You did a 4-hour stream. I did an hour and a half stream. Like, you can go and find it. Go to Ian's Rumble channel and take a look at this, because it really gets into the nitty gritty details. But overall, what was your takeaway at the end of this? Like, after doing the research, after getting into, you know, the details of this document, just what was your impression after seeing it all and sitting back and taking it all in? What is your takeaway from this?
I mean, my takeaway initially is just confirmation of what, like, conspiracy circles have known for a long time. And we've had small amounts of disclosure about government drug trafficking and money laundering for ages. But this expands the scope so much larger in terms of, like, the past history of Vietnam War era drug smuggling, et cetera. But it also paints a really striking picture of how that scheme moved forwards into the modern day. Officials at the highest level of governments all around the world had knowledge of these schemes and were complicit in it to a certain degree. And I've since been researching the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is in the FBI report is directly quoted as saying a front for the Rothschild banking empire.
Right.
And the OECD is responsible for, like, international aid and global corporate oversight all around the world. And they set up a anti-money laundering coalition that is, like, the foremost authority in the world on countering money laundering for drug trafficking and terrorism financing. And it really is like the fox guarding the hen house in a lot of ways, right?
Exactly. And of course, that's what they do, in the same way that you'll get child trafficking charges against organizations whose entire purpose is to stop child trafficking. It's very convenient to get away with things when you're the police that are, you know, supposed to be stopping it. So for people who don't know, essentially this document, it was written by the FBI, but it's about the CIA activities, which is another interesting thing you point out in your coverage that I found extremely interesting. The sort of combat between the FBI and the CIA, we'll get into that in just a second, but essentially lays out a timeline with names and everything on how the CIA entered into the drug smuggling business during the war in Vietnam. And of course, that led to the Iran-Contra scandal. Everybody knows about that, but they don't know about how it got started. And the names in this, George H.W. Bush, William Lansdale, William Colby, and then there's Robert Ferreira. Tell us about Robert Ferreira, because I know that's what you covered. You centered your coverage around, and you know, you call him the real life Jason Bourne. I mean, this guy, if what's said in this document is true, this dude is like the super spy of super spies. Who's Robert Ferreira? Were you able to uncover anything beyond this document?
Yeah, a little bit. There are small tidbits about Ferreira out there on the internet. In particular, he was arrested at one point in the mid-2000s, and it went to court. It kind of felt like it was a CIA sting operation. I've not finished my dig on that, but he is a Mexican national, and those court documents associated with that other issue specifically refer to him as a major general of the Mexican military in some regard, which is interesting because what the FBI report and the subsequent documents in the Five Star Trust cache lay out is that the government of Mexico was actually heavily involved in this operation. There's letters to President Salinas, one of the first international aid, quote unquote, aid operations that they had planned was a land bridge in Mexico that they were planning on laundering a bunch of this drug money to go and pay for that. So just more interesting connections. And he has since disappeared and faked his own death. But he really does come across, like, everyone always imagines spies as these sort of like secret, like blacklist people that you could never find on the internet and that are actually just ghosts in the machine that can kill at will and launder money and speak a million languages, and right. And the spies that we all know about are actually just like fat rich dudes that are really stupid that right. Are on TV all the time. And Robert Ferreira is definitely what we all imagine a spy as being, as is directly documented in that FBI report.
Right. And even in the FBI report, you know, they even say, like, this is what we've been able to kind of figure out about Ferreira, but there's no documentation about him. He's not in any of the official list. He's a ghost for all intents and purposes. Yet he's like, you know, it's like if you're studying the stars and there's a weird, you know, gravity anomaly, like there's got to be somebody doing this. We don't know who it is. Well, it turns out it's Ferreira. And it's interesting to hear about the mid-2000s thing, because when I was doing research into this, I found one story that talked about Robert Ferreira, and it is sort of the strangest. I want you to see this. It's incredible. It's from the Chicago Tribune in 1996. The headline is "Fake General Gets 71-Month Term." Robert Ferreira was a career con artist who would be so convincing that authorities covertly listening in on his sales pitches second-guessed themselves on whether he had connections to the president of Mexico, as he claimed. And they even say, you know, according to him, he's like the Forrest Gump of the CIA. And they're painting this as ridiculous, outrageous. There's no way it's real because it's so crazy what he's claiming to be a part of. But it seems like it's actually real. He was arrested November 1993 at New York Plaza Hotel after he tried to transfer $400 million of the bogus Mexican promissory notes to an undercover FBI agent. So again, this seems like the FBI and CIA sort of, you know, battling each other. So the CIA operative who's been super valuable to them gets arrested by the FBI for, you know, money laundering. And it seems like they got him. So do you think this is the Robert Ferreira that we know? Is this a different Robert Ferreira? And of course, they're saying, oh, he's a total fake. He's a total fraud. And listen to all of the things he says. He says his scams didn't stop there. In a purported resume that Ferreira gave one of his associates in the late 80s, he claimed to be a sort of Forrest Gump of the CIA. But he really was, wasn't he? I mean, if this FBI document, the what I call the Eagle 2 document, or this document to Ted Kennedy, I mean, he was involved in everything. And part of what gave him the influence he had is he actually had a hand in helping the Rothschilds escape Nazi Germany. And so he sort of had a lean on them and could get a lot of access to things through that. But had you seen that story about the fake general, the Forrest Gump of the CIA?
I've not seen that article, but I've seen a few other reports that are referencing that same incident. And you're absolutely right that it sounds like an FBI sting of Ferreira when he was conducting CIA operations. And it sure is helpful for the CIA to have inside people at the news agencies
right.
to help report on such scandalous and outlandish and obviously fake stories. And you're really on point to bring up the connection to the Rothschilds, because reading through the FBI report, which anyone can and should do, it's only 22 pages.
And it's like the best, really it's like the best novel you've ever read, dude. This isn't your normal FBI. I mean, some of the lines from this, sorry to interrupt, but like people should read this even if they just want something thrilling to read, you know, before bed. It's an amazing document, but I'm sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Absolutely. No. And it really paints the picture of how spy, like people at Ferreira's level, these high level operatives are, they're not just company men. They're also, cultivating their own influence, cultivating their own connections, and calling those connections in when they need to. If they're threatened, if operations go south, if what they think is right is not. And we should talk a little bit about Ferreira's like morals and ethics, and how him actually turning on the CIA right. is the reason why we have all these documents, and why he had to eventually fake his own death and disappear into the ether, because he actually got pissed off that the U.S. government was literally selling all of these drugs, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of drugs over the years, to American servicemen and into the American homeland, which is the craziest plot twist any story could ever have.
Right. Because he was fine with selling drugs when he thought they were being sold to like Vietnamese people. I think that, you know, you could even see it as like, well, this is sort of another form of warfare. We're attacking them with tanks and missiles and planes, but we're also going to be poisoning their people with, you know, kind of like the Opium War style, like drug the people. But then he learns, oh, no, we're selling it to the Vietnam servicemen, which to me explains why Vietnam soldiers came back addicted to heroin, why they, you know, were so destroyed when they came back. That was the American government actively selling drugs to the soldiers, and it seemed like that was a line that Ferreira didn't want them to cross. And when they crossed, he pulled out. But the same thing happened to Colby, right? They promised him he would be the head of the CIA, and when they didn't fulfill that, he started threatening to release this information. So you're right; it's not like the CIA is some monolithic organization where everybody acts in tandem. You've got rogue agents, you've got blackmail, you've got all of this sordid activity in the background of people trying to influence and coerce one another. And some of the lines from this document, I mean, are like unbelievable, but then they're true. This one here: before the operation was really off the ground, Colby, that's William Colby, eventual head of the CIA, started his phase of elimination of dissidents, and he did so under the codename of Phoenix Program. You can look that up. Colby became insane with his power. Before he was finished with Phoenix, over 20,000 suspects were executed, and 2,500 U.S. citizens were accused of Colby of being collaborators, and they vanished. I mean, that is a insane with power, killing 20,000 people before the operation even began. It's like, to understand the power these people have is terrifying.
Yeah. And that it's interesting how it kind of runs in cycles. And the FBI report details how they had different levels of expertise, and Colby was a complete psychopath, and they tried to pull him out of there because he was just way over the top. I mean, they need psychopaths, but they don't need people that are quite that psychopathic.
Right.
But then in the future, it also lays out how then William Casey, the another future head of CIA, he got brought in later on, and he was not part of the original operation, and he didn't quite have the expertise that people like the five that made the original Eagle II program happen. And he was the one that was in charge of setting up all of the Iran-Contra connections and all right. the drug smuggling through Central and South America. And we should talk for a little bit about how it's like the report really details how Ferreira is the one that is eventually responsible for the exposure of Oliver North and the whole Iran-Contra scandal, because Ferreira is the one that killed, or at least it alleges that he ordered the hit on Alder Berryman Seal, which was like the central node of the drug smuggling through Panama and up into the United States during that time, which was, by the way, flooding the black communities in America with crack cocaine, amongst lots of other drugs. And so it's this, if you like go read the Wikipedia page, it says that the cartels put out the hit on Alder Berryman Seal, and it makes obviously no mention of Ferreira or the American government. But this FBI report very directly claims, and it doesn't say it's like, it doesn't express any uncertainty about the fact that Ferreira killed him because he was pissed off that someone was smuggling drugs into the United States. And it even details a phone call where Ferreira calls up Bill Casey, this director of the CIA, and says, "Hey, is this guy working for you?" And Bill Casey is scared of Ferreira, so he says no, and then immediately gets off the phone with Ferreira and calls his like basically his boss, Richard Helms, the old director of the CIA, and he's like, "Boss, we have a problem."
Right.
And Helms tells him to sort it out, and he fails to sort it out, and Ferreira kills his guy, and that leads to this whole cascading of dominoes falling that eventually has Oliver North on the stand in front of the United States public, admitting to all of those operations that just got exposed.
I mean, the number of things connected to this, it's Iran-Contra, it's George H.W. Bush, and I believe so. This was from 1989, right? At some point in this document, they say, you know, where Bush was groomed for his current position, at which point he was president of the United States, if I'm not mistaken, or was he vice president at that point?
But correct. He was president,
right? So they literally are saying, yeah, this is why he was put in position for his, you know, the spot he currently occupies, which is president of the United States. I mean, the number of things you can glean from this, you can pull out from this, the number of people whose names you know, and things you can certify by just, you know, if you look up the Phoenix program, there's a Wikipedia article on it. There's so many, you know, ways this is connected to absolutely everything. And one of them is that, you know, George H.W. Bush was picked as one of the first five members of this team because of his expertise with China. And of course, the whole thing was about selling heroin. And George H.W. Bush's nickname is Poppy. And they say that was because he looked like his grandpa. But it sounds a little bit more like maybe it had something to do with the poppies that he was in charge of selling. Just little things like that you pick up when you read this and do further research. Do you think the nickname Poppy had anything to do with his job as the number one seller of opium in the entire world?
I think you are 100% on point there. And if you think about, if you draw connections forwards, I mean, he raised a pretty awful child who's most famous for invading Afghanistan and exploding the poppy production in Afghanistan from almost zero under the Taliban. I mean, there's lots of bad things about the Taliban, but they do outlaw the cultivation of poppies and opium and et cetera. George Bush invades and suddenly opium production skyrockets and voila, we have an opioid epidemic. So it really sounds like if George Bush wasn't necessarily smart enough to run his own version of this, someone behind him was getting some ideas from his daddy. And I mean, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has all the same markers of everything in this story.
100%. And you know, my big takeaway from the whole thing was the understanding, as you point out, the OECD, basically it says that basically the CIA, as we know it, is not controlled by the people we think are in charge, right? This operation was originally kicked off, and they say, you know, not the real head of the CIA, but the sort of shadow head. You know, it goes to John Foster Dulles, who at the time was retired, but he was still the godfather of the CIA, and he was still making decisions and making orders. And then the whole operation gets going, and you get this shadow CIA operation, and then that gets handed over to this Cooperation of International Economic Development Fund, which is a Rothschild bank operation, basically headquartered in Paris. This was really, you know, crucial to my understanding that when we say intelligence community, that's an international community. It's not the intelligence community of America. There's this intelligence community that exists above and beyond national sovereignty and national loyalty. Can you talk a little bit about that and the way that this started with the CIA, but has since become something even bigger?
I think that this is probably the most important topic for all people around the world to understand today, honestly, is understanding like the modus operandi of intelligence agencies, because since the Cold War, since World War II, all governments operate in covert clandestine operations at all times. So like all government policy, it revolves around the way you do these covert operations, like, because everything is constantly in the shadows. Everyone is constantly making deals. We're no longer going to overt war except as a tool for the covert wars.
Right.
And if you just go to, like, it's critical to understand the history of the CIA, which was only founded since World War II. And it was founded by two corporate lawyers, the Dulles brothers. And understanding how it was founded by two corporate lawyers with strong ties to Nazis that often went behind the president of the United States' back directly in order to look out for Nazi business interests, that starts to paint the picture of how the CIA, since its founding, has actually been sort of its own body, achieving its own objectives. Then it's sure it's like authorized by the president and they have interactions with the president. But over the years, they have certainly operated outside the purview of like U.S. Desires. And in many ways, it seems as though they have worked over time to capture the president's office, as was achieved when George H.W. Bush became the president. And I'm sure there's never been another example of a CIA-chosen president since then, obviously.
Right, of course.
But if you go to the OECD's website today, right now, they have basically a quarter of their website is dedicated to the war in Ukraine.
Mm.
If you just think about it, it's like, I can't imagine what's going on over there.
I think you're exactly right. This is the most important thing when understanding what's going on in the world, the geopolitical machinations that we just barely see a glimpse of under the surface. I really do, and I try to make the point over and over, understanding that the intelligence community is an international organization that's operating for its own benefit, regardless of what would benefit the people in the countries that they supposedly serve. I mean, once you understand that, everything sort of clicks into place. I mean, this is the real history of the last 60 years, really. I mean, they'll talk about agreements and treaties and all this sort of stuff. And when you talk about the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, Dulles, by the way, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, he personally was there at the negotiations for the Treaty of Versailles, and it was his, like, he is responsible for the clause that placed all of the blame on Germany that eventually led to World War II because of the crushing economic, you know, policies destroying Germany that created this, the atmosphere in which the Nazi Party could rise. That was all because of this one clause in the Treaty of Versailles that was John Foster Dulles's one contribution to the Treaty of Versailles. So it's like when you start looking into these guys, the connections they have and the things they start that eventually lead to these bigger things, it's mind-blowing. It is absolutely mind-blowing. And that's just another connection that sort of blew my mind when I first discovered it, that it was John Foster Dulles that set the stage for Nazi Germany because his one contribution to the Treaty of Versailles was that blame clause that he put in.
It's worth noting, too, that after World War II, the Dulles brothers were instrumental in the Marshall Plan and the talks that established the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and basically setting up the entire global monetary system today. And now when you put the OECD into that equation as well, the OECD is sort of like this oversight committee that monitors global money laundering and et cetera. I mean, they really have all bases covered, and it's by design. And they've just been legislating it more and more and more into established order ever since.
I'll just say it again. I'm just so excited. Somebody like yourself is digging their teeth into this. Literally for 4 years, I've been trying to get people to pay attention to this document. And I just can't say how thrilled I am that someone like yourself, because again, I thought I did a lot of research. My goodness, the research you've done blows mine out of the water. More on the other side with Ian Carroll on X at Cancel Cloco. That's Cancel C-L-O-C-O. Cancel This Conspiracy on Rumble, where you can find his 4-hour live stream digging in to this all-important document. We'll be back on the other side with more. And we're barely getting started, folks. Trust us. There's a lot to come. I'm literally giddy that we're talking about this. I'm so thrilled. I won't keep repeating that, but just these names, hearing these names, Marion Horn, Robert Ferreira, William Lansdale. It's thrilling to me that we're talking about this, and it's getting more exposure thanks to my guest, Ian Carroll, based textile merchant, cancelthisclothingcompany.com. That's cancelthisclothingcompany.com. Cancel This Conspiracy on Rumble and on X at cancelcloco. And you're on TikTok as well. That's really where you got your start, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I started on TikTok somewhat intentionally because it was an easy place to grow a platform. And once that platform grew. Then I branched. Thank goodness I branched out, because Twitter is where I meet people like you. Twitter is where I get to troll the politicians in their comment sections, et cetera. So.
And I first became aware of your work, I think, because of what you were doing to study BlackRock. And I know in your stream you were saying, you know, you didn't really start off to get involved in conspiracies. You just want to talk about economy and stocks and just sort of follow the money. And yet you end up, you know, here talking about, you know, the CIA. What's that journey been like for you?
It's kind of inevitable, I think, is if you want to understand the global monetary system, you eventually wind up learning that you need to understand the global intelligence network systems. And my modus operandi from the beginning was just, there's so much, is first and foremost, acknowledge how much you don't know, and then start researching what seems most important. And in that case, it seemed like money and ownership and BlackRock is just the obvious first step of understanding who owns everything in our world. But then that naturally leads to so many other questions, because there's so much that I don't know. So I see anything in that research I don't understand, I start researching that. And then I see more I don't understand, I start researching that. And so it's really just been a process of me actually putting in the time to learn what's going on in a real way, not just in a cursory, I watched a documentary way.
Right.
And that one thing naturally leads to another. And now here we are.
Yeah. And you know, my theory is, you know, not only is the intelligence community international in character, but it serves the banks above everybody else. And my theory is that this is because banks originally, like you hear about the Rothschilds, they had the five different banks and the five different capitals, and they sort of invented the paper check, right? That you could deposit money in one bank, travel to a different country, and then withdraw the money from a different bank. And so they had to establish, just out of necessity, a very secure, very efficient communication network. And then you hear about, you know, Nathaniel Rothschild knew about the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo in, you know, 1871 or whenever, you know, it'd be earlier than that. But he basically bought out the entire UK stock market because he had the information before anybody else, and everybody knew he had the information before anybody else. So it sort of just makes sense in a linear fashion, the way that these banks have these intelligence networks that are better than the national intelligence networks, who still have to rely on diplomats and official, you know, modes of communication. And so it's sort of natural that the banks use that intelligence, and those intelligence networks sort of merge with the state. And so it's not like intelligence networks were captured by banks. I think they sort of started with the banks.
I agree completely. I think that you're exactly right that, I mean, if you take America as an example, we did not really have an intelligence network prior to World War II. I mean, I'm sure we had diplomats and we had like a few spies, but it was nothing compared to what the world looks like today. During World War II, the OSS was established, and that was its own can of worms and largely absolutely bizarre and toothless.
Right.
But you can look at the people that were founding these things, and they're like corporate lawyers, corporate lawyers, corporate lawyers, bankers, bankers, bankers. And it really looks, I mean, if you think about the powers that bankers and international corporations have, they have a lot. They have almost all the power in the world,
yep.
Except they do not have the legal backing of a government or state to conduct violence legally. That's
right.
Like the one thing that a banker can't do. And I'm sure they knew that. I'm sure that they realized that governments can declare war and we technically cannot, although they'd been doing it through governments very successfully. And so post-World War II, Alan Dulles, our favorite, was instrumental in lobbying the U.S. government and the president at the time, who both the two presidents involved were not super keen on actually establishing the CIA. And it was an arduous process of convincing them that we need to establish the CIA. And then the first 10 to 20 years of the CIA's history was actually a very elaborate process of covering up all failures and wrongdoings of the CIA so that the president would continue to support the idea of having a CIA, because the ability to legally conduct secret violence on behalf of a state is absolutely essential to what the CIA has done ever since, and all global intelligence networks. And once they gained that power, there's really nothing that these, I'm just going to call them globalist networks, can't do, right? Because they control the financial system. They now control the covert violence system. They control the information flow systems. And another key avenue of research that I've gone down a lot because of that is the global think tank networks of advisors, policymakers and researchers that are sort of the ones establishing the narrative about what is happening in the world and how different things will affect different parts of the world.
I mean, it's impressive. You have to admit it's impressive what they've been able to pull off. And it was impressive before they launched this, you know, what this paper is all about, which is just the complete severing of any oversight by the actual elected government. I mean, that's what the purpose of all of this was, right? They said, we want to be able to have our own money. We want to have no oversight, because at the time, the only oversight that Congress could really exercise was the purse strings. And so if you create an alternative income system, well, now the U.S. government has really no oversight whatsoever in your clandestine activities. And then that organization is then sent off to the international cooperation, you know, the OECD. And now it's a completely rogue and yet still empowered with the you know, violence, as you point out. I mean, it is very sophisticated at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And so you know, I mean, go ahead.
If you look at the amount of money involved on the like, let's say, white and black sides of this, like the covert and overt sides of this, the OECD on Wikipedia, apparently their total budget for 2023 was 338 million euros with an M, million. These documents directly allege that the OECD has access to trillions of US dollars of gold and money and assets through these illicit funds. So that's like an order of magnitude 1,000 times greater or so for their illicit funding as it is for their like legal and overt funding.
Right.
And it makes me, you can only imagine what these kinds of, like, we're talking about an organization and an exposure of operations back in the 70s, 80s. I'm sure it's went into the 90s and 2000s, but you can only imagine the kinds of things that these people are doing now with technology, cryptocurrency, social media, et cetera.
It is, it's terrifying. You know, it's like how the Rothschilds never show up on the Forbes top 100 list, even though they own literally everything. But it just doesn't show up for some reason. It's very interesting how that works out. There's just so much more to get to. We'll have another 10-minute segment on the other side of a quick commercial break here. But just real quick, in the next minute or so, who is Marion Horn and how does he play into this document?
Really good lead-in question. Marion Horn was the front man for the money laundering operation because they didn't want a card-carrying CIA operative to be tied to the bank accounts that the money that they started with one account. They needed to get money out of Japan. And they needed it to go from a non-Japanese government person to a non-American government person. And they were really careful in finding someone that had all the skills and qualifications, but was not well known and was not super famous and not a person that anyone would notice or ask questions about. And Marion Horn emerged as the guy that was willing to do gray area deals and had all the experience they needed, but did not have associations that would bring any unwanted attention to him. That later backfired on them real hard when they tried to betray him. And that's where this whole story came out of and then later got released because of. But originally, Marion Horn was recruited by the CIA to be their front man and the name on the bank accounts.
And then he started making trouble for him. And we'll get into how that spiraled out of control. And I mean, this involves the Obama administration. It involves the Biden administration. This is the real history. I mean, this is what is really deciding the geopolitical reality of our world. More with Ian Carroll on the other side. Don't go anywhere, folks. Final segment, and it'll be an explosive one. Stay with us. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the American Journal, Infowars.com, band.video. Share those links. Share this video. Share the documents. Share the information of our guest, Ian Carroll, at Cancel Cloco on X, Cancel CLCO on X, Cancel This Conspiracy on Rumble, and his website is cancelthisclothingcompany.com. And we are waging the info war. And just talking about this incredible document, I call it the Eagle 2 document. Ian's video on it is called the 5-Star Trust, which is just another aspect to this, or just another way to call it. And this was my process in researching this, Ian. I would read something like this. Okay, this is from this document. It says, the plan was in full force when the United States government encountered continued opposition to its request from the Japanese government ruling party to put CIA-controlled people in power. Bush, that's George H.W. Bush, personally picked an obscure party formed in 1955, bankrupt and with very little membership, to back in a possible takeover of government. And it was the Liberal Democrat Party, Liberal Democratic Party of Japan. And so you go over to Wikipedia, you type Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, and look at that there on Wikipedia. It says, from the 1950s to the early 1970s, the United States Central Intelligence Agency spent millions of dollars to aid the LDP against leftist parties such as the Socialists and the Communists, although this was not revealed until the mid-90s when it was exposed by the New York Times. And that's the type of confirmation that you discover over and over again in this document. And not only did the Liberal Democratic Party, did they succeed in taking it over in Japan in the 1950s, to this day, it's still a very sizable power, a force in Japanese politics. And Shinzo Abe, former president of Japan, was actually, or prime minister rather, was a liberal Democrat. So this has been so successful for them, this tactic of capturing a party in Japan. It's still ruling to this day, and it's still probably a puppet of the CIA. This type of stuff just blew my mind over and over going through this document.
Yep, and it's worth noting that the documents allege that that was specifically General Ferreira. Like, they came up with the idea to back the Liberal Democratic Party based upon George H.W. Bush's selection of that party. But then later on, General Ferreira suggested that, like, hey, you guys are spending so much money trying to buy out just the leadership and buy out the most important person. Why don't you just start a bunch of businesses in Japan and then launder money through them and use all of those businesses to fund everyone in Japan, right? Like, fund all of the small politicians on the way up, basically what AIPAC does here in the United States.
Right.
And that established this whole network of where now it's not just that they've bought one party in Japan, they've bought the entire political system in Japan so that the party that they're backing is backed by everyone. And it hadn't quite occurred to me, because I'm not actually that smart until I start to research things, that when I looked at it all and I thought more about the geopolitics of the Pacific, I realized just how important Japan is, and especially was post-World War II, to America's defense and to defense against China, a bulwark against China containing them in the South China Sea. You start to think geopolitically from the perspective of the CIA, and suddenly the reasons for their operations, the reason for putting hundreds of billions of dollars into capturing Japan, becomes pretty apparent.
Right. And of course, we outsourced all of the, you know, production of electronics there in the 80s. I mean, this stuff, it really pervades every economics, warfare. I mean, it is all pervasive. And so, of course, you mentioned Marion Horn was one of the people they wanted to use to get the money out of Japan. And again, it's not like these guys are all powerful. I don't want to portray these guys as just being able to do whatever they want, whenever they want. They have to do things in response to, you know, what I just discussed, right? The plan was in full force when the United States government encountered continued oppositions to its request from the Japanese government ruling party. If there are people in power that want to investigate this, they have to then come up with a strategy to defeat that. They're not all powerful. They can be confronted and contained and opposed at various levels. Then they have to deal with it. They have to, you know, change their tactics in one way or another. So that to me, I don't want to portray them as all powerful, operating in total secrecy, and it doesn't matter if we find out, because they're just going to keep doing it. We can resist this. You can put a stop to this if you have the right people in power and if you can sort of learn their strategies and come up with strategies to counter it. So I think that's an important point to focus on. I think Marion Horn sort of plays into this. He caused a lot of trouble for them. Tell us about what Marion Horn got up to. You gave us the overview in the last segment, but what happened once Marion Horn started making noise?
Yeah, I'm going to make a very long story very short. Marion Horn was their front guy, and it was all going to go perfectly. And then Richard Helms realized he wanted to fund the Nicaraguan Contras, and he decided, rather than spinning down this operation in Japan because it was getting a little out of hand, he decided to reverse the deal that Marion Horn was the front of and spin it all back up. And they figured they would just put Marion Horn in jail for a little thingamajing. But he got away, he got out, and he then proceeded to start to try to legally protect himself by collecting documents, collecting friends and favors. And over the course of many, many years, a couple decades really, he started to clash with the CIA, and at times they were still working together, and at times he was doing back deals to collect protection documents and such. And it goes all the way into the 2000s and into the 2010s. And we actually have this whole document cache and the secret FBI report because in prison in 2012, Marion Horn Jr. met a man named Ken Pelock. I think that's his real name. It might be an alias. And then Ken Pelock just proceeded to get involved to verify the accounts and then to help Marion Horn with a bunch of legal matters. They wrote a bunch of letters. They wrote a letter to They'd already written a letter to the George Bush White House, George Bush II, years prior. And then they wrote a letter to the Obama White House. And later on, they wrote a letter to the Biden White House once it was the Biden White House. And eventually, Ken Pelock published a book called Dirty Laundry, which you can buy on Amazon. I just bought it this last week and read it all. And it explains how and why we have all of these documents, because Ken Pelock was involved in getting them for Marion Horn, trying to get Marion Horn out of jail, trying to get Ken Pelock out. He was just trying to grift, sort of, like to help himself get out by helping Marion Horn.
Right.
But not in. And he actually, in the back of the book, in the appendix, he has all of the different documents, because there's the FBI report. But then Marion Horn has like a whole multi-hundred page dossier of affidavits, of letters between the power players, of bank account statements, all sorts of corroborative evidence that he created as his, basically his life insurance file. And that later got leaked onto the internet, and you can find that on the internet now too. And it's also in the back of this book. So the, like you were saying, the CIA is not all powerful, and they have to play within whatever guidelines are out there. And they are constantly trying to write new guidelines to make the playing field more friendly to them. But there's a million ways that people like Marion Horn can get out of line and cause trouble. There's a million ways that people like you and me can talk about it and spread awareness, and that causes trouble. And that's, I mean, honestly, that's why I think that people like you talking on InfoWars, talking on all these shows about what's going on, is one of the most important things that regular people like us can do and can pay attention to. Because the moment that enough of the public knows something is real, that's the moment that disclosure has to happen. That's the moment that the government, the CIA, whoever's doing it, has to reconcile or change strategies or at least wind operations down. I mean, that's how the Iran-Contra North scandal came out, is the press got a hold of it, it made a big noise. And if the people won't put up with something, things will change. But the first step is talking about it.
Absolutely. 100%. Of course, that they recognize that, which is why they put in so many resources into controlling the media and to stopping this type of information from getting out. Because after all, this is a national security issue, and you wouldn't want to be responsible for, you know, causing Americans to die or whatever. Right. They're very, very convenient the way that they operate the media that should be covering this sort of stuff. Have you found anything in the mainstream media that, you know, corroborates this or is reporting on any of this outside of the Iran-Contra debacle?
Not at all. It's almost like there's a list of government corruption that has been exposed that passes a threshold and then is allowed to be mainstream. It's like, okay, right, we'll put this one out in the mainstream. It'll get a Wikipedia page. They got us. And they very intentionally, selectively add and subtract from that list. And even things that us, the people, know, like the Hunter Biden laptop is a great example of one that we all know it's real. Yep. Because we can go look at it on the internet. It's like very clear. But that one has not yet passed the threshold. It is still on Wikipedia, like a conspiracy and all, like, you know. So, and I assume that that's because there are a lot of ongoing operations right now that rely on us not fully exposing the extent of what the Biden-Ukraine connection is. Because 100%. The OECD is directly tied to Ukraine, based yep. upon whatever they're doing over it. So, you know, one is still in the.
And again, this is the type of thing where, like, when they first launched the first Trump impeachment over Ukraine, to those of us who were paying attention, it was obvious, okay, this wasn't about some phone call he made, some pressure he put on. It's the fact that there are these tangled webs that center on Ukraine, and if you start pulling one string, suddenly the whole thing unravels. So when you understand the true scope of what's going on, it can actually, you know, give you insight into different little political machinations here in the States. Man, I wish we had more time. Of course, we could spend 4 hours, as you did, going through this document. Thank you so much for joining us. Ian Carroll, Cancel Cloco on X, Cancel This Conspiracy on Rumble, Cancel This Clothing Company.com is the website. Support this man. Watch his research. Have fun digging in along with Ian Carroll. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you so much, Harrison.